This course will be an attempt to look at relatively current issues concerning Israel and how they relate to the Ezekiel 38 prophecy. Not long ago, we studied the restoration of Israel in Volume 3 on Thursday evenings, so my interest was piqued to further investigation. The thoughts I will express are what I have come to believe. I am not dogmatic. I realize other brethren may have ideas perhaps different than what I will present. And I easily admit the possibility that I could be persuaded to see and agree with other thoughts. As time goes on, prophetic events become clearer. So I ask your indulgence with what you hear. Giving a talk related to prophecy requires a large element of supposition. And therefore, some brethren may prefer a different subject matter. But prophecy is included in a great percentage of the written word. And as the completion of the church draws to a conclusion, some may find an increased faith in considering unfulfilled prophecy as a motivator for greater effort in overcoming. Jesus told us to watch and pray. And in his great prophecy of Matthew 24, he gave us signs to observe to consider the end of the age. Moreover, in Isaiah 42, verse 9, our Lord God tells us, "Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them." Until the actual events occur, we can only surmise. I plan to bring current events into my discussion, but as we all know, current events are current, but for a short time. I hope what I'm willing to tell you is reasonable, but most of all, that it has some value. The 83rd Psalm is an account of Israel's enemies who sought her ruin. Excuse me. The account seems to apply to all the confederacies of Israel's neighboring nations that go against her. This is shown in verses 1 through 8 of Psalm 83, as displayed on the current slide. In verses 9 through 18, an earnest prayer is made that those enemies would be humbled and defeated, so Israel, God's people, would be preserved and God's glory manifested. You recall, after the flood, Noah's three sons, Japheth, Ham, and Shem, and their offspring were credited with populating different areas of the earth that over time became nations. This slide indicates the general directions each son's posterity influenced. Looking at Psalm 83, verses 4 and 5, they have said, that is, this is Israel's surrounding neighbors, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee." Then the scriptures go on to list the nations who desire to cut Israel off, and those you just saw on the previous slide. Edom. The Edomites were descendants of Esau, Jacob's twin brother. Since Isaac was Esau's father, the Edomites were a Semitic race, but with a definite Hamitic influence, since Esau had two Hamitic wives. If you look at the map of the Bible lands today, Edom, we believe, is located in the area of Saudi Arabia to the southeast of Israel. Continue with the list of names in Psalm 83. Ishmaelites. They were descendants of Ishmael, who was the firstborn son of Abraham, and his concubine Hagar, who was an Egyptian handmaid of Sarah. Ishmael married an Egyptian wife and had 12 sons. So you can see that the race was one quarter Semitic and three quarters Hamitic. God had promised to make them a great nation that could not be numbered. That's in Genesis 17:20 and Genesis 16:10. Further, intermarriage between descendants of Abraham and Ishmael resulted in a race of Arabs that occupied sections of Arabia. On today's map, we believe that could be areas of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Continuing with the list of names that go against Israel, Moab. He was the son of Lot. And you recall Lot was Abraham's nephew because he was the son of Abraham's brother Haran. Moab was the forerunner of the Moabites who resided in the area of current-day Jordan. Hagrites, most likely descendants of Hagar, and resided as shown. Ammon, Lot's son and the progenitor of the Amorites in northern Jordan. Amalek, son of Esau's firstborn, Eliphaz, with his concubine Timnah. So he was Esau's grandson. And we think maybe the Sinai Peninsula, Israel's southwest border. Gebel is thought to be a Phoenician city on the Mediterranean seacoast, somewhat north of Beirut. And of course, Philistines, these were the people who occupied the coastal plain of Canaan and were among the Israel's staunchest enemies. And that would be today, present-day Gaza and Ashkelon. Tyre is believed these to be the Canaanite people to the north of Israel that profited by trade. And Asher, the forefather of the Assyrians, and these people were located in present-day Iraq. So you can see that starting with Abraham, these peoples listed resulted from the mixture of Semitic people with the descendants from Shem's brothers. And as it turned out, they were brothers that could not get along. You recall the angel of the Lord spoke to Hagar when she ran from Sarah after conceiving a child with Abraham. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, "Hagar, Sarai's slave woman, from whence have you come, and where are you going?" And she said, "I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai." So the angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress and submit to her authority." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they will be too many to count." The angel of the Lord said to her further, "Behold, you are pregnant, and you will give birth to a son, and you shall name him Ishmael. Because the Lord has heard your affliction, but he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. And he will live in defiance of all his brothers." Thank you. We can see the personality of Isaac's half-brother, Ishmael. And that personality was carried forward to his offspring. This trait of stubbornness is common in many of the Middle East peoples of today. There's some guesswork as to the locations of the peoples enumerated in Psalm 83 that want to destroy Israel, but you can see how Israel is surrounded and would be vulnerable to attack from all sides. And again, as Psalm 83:4 tells us, "They have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee.' Israel has had wars with her neighbors in the not too distant past and has been victorious. Has this prophecy been fulfilled? Possibly, but I do not believe so. The year 2020 saw an unexpected offering of hopeful news about the peace in the Middle East. And this peace stands in opposition of suggesting a war with Israel's immediate neighbors. Both U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu have been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for creating the Abraham Accords, which is an agreement between the State of Israel and Arab states. And this includes the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, Bahrain, and then Morocco and Sudan as late joining partners, with the hopes of others to join in the future. These accords include diplomatic normalization between Israel and participating Arab states, as well as expanded economic and trade relations. This indeed is a diplomatic success, but we should consider the whole picture. Israel and the United Arab Emirates have had quiet security ties for more than a decade, and Israel has had a diplomatic office in Abu Dhabi since 2015. Sudan agreed to join only with the condition that they would be removed from the United States state-sponsored terrorist list. But sadly, Sudan's military leader seized power from the civilian government in October 2021 and made further progress in proving the relations with Israel unsustainable. As a result, aid programs from the United States to Sudan were suspended, and relations have not improved. And as we are aware from very recent nightly news, that Sudan is in a fierce battle for power between rival factions of the military government that began in April 2023. The opposition of cultures, religions, and ethnicities is the root of the problem. As for the United Arab Emirates, it was learned in October of 2022 that the UAE has sided with Russia, along with Saudi Arabia, to cut the OPEC oil production by 2 million barrels per day. And that caused hurtful economic problems for Western countries. In addition, the Russian-Ukraine war has curtailed the flow of oil from Russia to Europe, and that in a significant way. Europe would be put in an inflationary situation. They would have to ask, should we heat or eat? Certainly a political disaster. Moreover, all four accord partner countries are geographically distant from Israel, as you can see on the map. The problem with the surrounding adjacent nations of Israel stems from the occupation of the land the Palestinian claims is theirs. Now I'm showing a chart that shows the Palestinians occupying Israel at different points in time. And let's see if we can do this. You can see here that the green is Palestinians and the blue is Israeli. In 1917, which was the pre-Minish mandate period, you can see that the majority of the country is green, just very little bit on the edges is blue. But then in 1948, when Israel became a recognized nation, the Jewish control was 78% and they expelled 750,000 Palestinians. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now the West Bank, I can't put my highlight and magnification at the same time, but if I go like this, you can see the green area here, that's the West Bank, and Israel's right, or Jerusalem is right in that little area of the blue where it meets the green. And the Gaza Strip is over here on the coast. After the 1967 war, the Israelis occupied all of Israel and they expelled additional Palestinians. And you note the red outline of the Palestinian areas identifies those areas that are under Israeli occupation. And that would be the West Bank, as you see there. But there are many Israeli citizens that live in the West Bank, and they live in East Jerusalem also. If you've been to Jerusalem, you know that it's been divided up into various sections, Christian section, a Jewish section, a Muslim section. So the point is that not only are the Palestinians living there, but the Jews are living there also. You might recall the accords were brokered by President Clinton and signed by Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin for Israel and Yasser Arafat for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Israel accepted the PLO as the representative of the Palestinians, and the PLO renounced terrorism and recognized Israel's right to exist in peace. Both sides agreed that a Palestinian authority would be established and assume governing responsibilities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip over a five-year period. Then permanent status talks on the issues of borders, refugees, and Jerusalem would be held. There was much negotiation activity in trying to reach peace over the years. But on May 19, 2020, then Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared the end of all security coordination with Israel and the United States, including the landmark Oslo Accords and associated agreements. Since then, as this slide shows, President Abbas has sought favor from both the United States and Russia, pleading his case of abuse and exploitation. This next slide shows the mapping of Israel occupation. The source of this plat is the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics and is dated 2019. Israel is blamed for crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. The two areas where most Palestinians reside, as we talked about, were the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. The West Bank, at that date, contained 2.7 million Palestinians and 463,000 Israelis, and they called them settlers. East Jerusalem contained 345,000 Palestinians and 220,200 Israelis. The Israel-Palestinian Accords ultimately failed because neither is willing to compromise when it comes to the disputed lands and the displaced peoples. Israel controls the government and the courts in the occupied areas. Israel maintains its control by military occupation. They enforce the laws and restrictions as put forth by their own government. The state of Israel's occupation of Palestinian areas and its fear of violent threats seem to be the real sources of hostility in the conflict. But I believe the Abraham Accords have created a superficial peace between four nations that really are nominally in conflict. And it should be noted that further Israel annexation will almost assuredly occur. In fact, I have read Netanyahu approved the construction of 3,000 new homes in the occupied Palestinian territories of Israel on the very same day that his government approved the Abraham Accords. There are those that make efforts to understand the current conflicts. We know mankind often strains at getting along with his neighbor. I found it interesting that a statement coming from the Harvard International Review, peace must come from shared understandings, from agreements made on equal footing. Palestinian hostility will not be silenced by diplomatic treaties between exterior states, but by a change in the material conditions of their occupation. Palestinians who live in Israel do not like the idea that the Israeli government controls how they live. So we will have to review in detail the checkered history of many failed attempts between the Palestinians and Israelis to secure peace. Even when agreements are negotiated and signed, it is only a matter of time before the agreement is broken and violence appears. Seems to me that these Arab nations are still in agreement to destroy Israel, as we read in Psalm 83, verse 4. And at present, there does not exist true peace in the Middle East, but that is my view. I do not believe the conflicts can be settled peacefully. The current events of our day are rife with attempts to smear Israel before the world. Anti-Semitism runs deep, and as the world society unravels, it appears to be on the increase. From a Reuters April 17, 2023 news release titled, "Anti-Semitism Festers in the Current U.S. Political and Social Climate," more than 3,600 anti-Semitic incidents were recorded in the United States in 2022, more than any year since the Anti-Defamation League began tracking the issue in 1979. Moreover, the Anti-Semitism Worldwide Report 2021 by the Center for the Study of Contemporary European Jewry at the Tel Aviv University. It is based on the analysis of dozens of studies from around the world, as well as information from law enforcement bodies, media, and Jewish organizations. It says that in 2021, there was a significant increase in various types of anti-Semitic incidents in most countries with large Jewish population. It found that in the U.S., which is the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, the number of anti-Jewish hate crimes recorded in both New York and Los Angeles were almost twice that of the previous year. In France, the number of recorded anti-Semitic incidents increased by almost 75% compared with 2020. In Canada, a leading Jewish group reported a 40-year record in anti-Semitic physical violence in 1 month, August. In the UK, the number of recorded physical assaults against Jews increased by 78% compared with 2020. In Germany, anti-Semitic incidents recorded by police were up 29% compared with 2020 and 49% compared with 2019. Australia also experienced a sharp rise in recorded anti-Semitic incidents, with 88 in May alone, the highest monthly total ever. And from current events, terrorism, bombings, and missile launches into Israel, political outcry, propaganda before the world to identify Israel as the cause of many of its troubles, seems apparent that war with the nations that hate her and have vowed her destruction, those who immediately surround her as identified in Psalm 83, will take place before peace is established. I'm not dogmatic about any of the suppositions presented. This, though, is what I currently believe. And I just would like to highlight one of these slides here. I found this to be interesting. This is a shot of missiles being launched from the Gaza Strip into Israel. And you can see their defense system there that they throw up various determinants so that when the rockets come over, that they strike those and explode before they hit the ground. We now want to look at the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, where Israel will have another great conflict with a coalition of nations joining together to attack and plunder her This will be Israel's final battle and take place sometime after the war with Israel's surrounding nations. I believe that we just discussed what we did from the 83rd Psalm. It will be similar. The Lord is directing our thoughts that the second coalition will unite and go against Israel. And we know Israel is identified as people who were gathered from many nations, described as one that has recovered from war. The prophet informs us of this coalition that will go against Israel. Ezekiel 38, verse 8. After many days, you will be called to arms. In the future years, you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. They had been brought out from the nations, and now all of them will live in safety. I believe Israel will be at peace with its neighbors after an Israeli-Arab conflict, in which Israel will be victorious. We know that God's promise to Israel that the Holy Land belongs to the Jews forever has always been true and never forsaken. I like the supporting scriptures in Zechariah, and we know the book of Zechariah was written after the return from Babylon captivity and during the building of the second temple. Yet Zechariah prophesied a future regathering of Israel to its land, eventually culminating in Jerusalem becoming the capital of God's kingdom on earth. Briefly, scriptures supporting the regathering. Zechariah 8, 7 and 8. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will save my people from the east country and from the west country, and I will bring them, and they shall dwell in the midst of Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in truth and in righteousness. Zechariah 8:13, and it shall come to pass that as you were a curse among the heathen, O house of Judah and house of Israel, so will I save you, and ye shall be a blessing. Fear not, but let your hands be strong. Then the support for Jerusalem as the capital of the world. Jeremiah 3:17, at that time they will call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all nations will assemble at it, at Jerusalem, for the name of the Lord, and they will no longer follow the stubbornness of their evil heart. And in Micah 4, verses 1 and 2, this is from the New Living Translation. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be the highest of all, the most important place on earth. It will be raised above the other hills, and people from all over the world will stream there to worship. People from many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of Jacob's God. There he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the Lord's teaching will go out from Zion, his word will go out from Jerusalem. Well, let's now read about the battle as described in Ezekiel 38. We realize that Ezekiel 38 is a highly symbolic account of the final battle between Israel, representing God's people, and the forces of our enemies, represented by a coalition of nations with evil intent. I believe this battle takes place just prior to the kingdom being fully established. So we conclude the church is complete or close to being complete when the battle ensues. The enemies of Israel that form the confederacy are enumerated in the first seven verses of Ezekiel 38. Now the word of the Lord came to me saying, son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, this is what the Lord God says. Behold, I am against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, So I will turn you around and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them magnificently dressed, a great contingent with shield and buckler, all of them wielding swords, Persia, Cush, and Put with them, all of them with buckler and helmet, Gomer with all its troops, Beth Togarmah from the remote parts of the north with all its troops, many peoples with you. Be ready and be prepared, you and all your contingents that are assembled around you, and be a guard for them. It's interesting that in verse 2, a number of translations read, Son of man, set thy face toward Gog, the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. This identifies Gog with the prince of Rosh. The prince of Rosh is added in 10 translations that I found, including the American Standard Version, the Amplified Bible, the Orthodox Jewish Bible, and the Modern English Version. The word Rosh in Hebrew means head, top, chief. And this agrees with the translations that use chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, like the King James or the New American Standard. But the thought is the word Rosh describes the greatness of this prince as a ruler in Magog, the place of Gog. We suggest Gog could be a name for Satan, the prince of this world. And we know that from John 12:31. We know he is in control of the nations and rules over them. And in Revelation 20, verse 8, the time when the little season begins, after Satan is released from his 1,000-year prison sentence, we read, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. This shows there will be an assembling of people under the authority and influence of Gog, very similar to the forces described in Ezekiel 38 that to go battle Israel. Strong's Concordance defines Magog as Magog, a foreign nation that is figuratively an anti-Christian party. Magog could represent Gog's spiritual cohorts as well as the place of the earthly gathering of those who do not accept the terms and intent of the new covenant. And this group or place or position is under Gog's control, at least for a time. So it is a suggestion, and only a suggestion, a thought that I've had for a number of years, that Gog may be a term for Satan, where he is in control of the nations described in this battle as the prince or head of the assault. Here's what I tend to believe. God draws Gog to the battle by restoring and prospering Israel. The scriptures say the Lord will turn Gog around and put hooks into his jaws and direct his attention to Israel. Perhaps this is taking the attention away from the East versus West conflicts, such as the Ukraine-Russian war, and even bigger, NATO versus the Eastern Bloc countries, and directing Gog to pursue the supposed vulnerable but highly coveted Israel. Israel exists in presumed safety after an Arab-Israeli war. Ezekiel 38, 8 and 9 supports this. This is from the New Living Translation. A long time from now, you will be called into action. In the distant future, you will swoop down on the land of Israel, which will be enjoying peace after recovering from war and after its people have returned from many lands to the mountains of Israel. You and all your allies, a vast and awesome army, will roll down on them like a storm and cover the land like a cloud. Gog is the leader of the last hostile attack of the world powers on God's chosen people. The nations that form the Confederacy and attack Israel are identified by their names and therefore their presumed locations. The chart displayed on the screen shows the genealogical table of the descendants of Noah. Recall how we mentioned the three sons' names, Japheth, Ham, and Shem, earlier in their presumed directions of populating the earth. Now, the names of the several peoples that joined together in Ezekiel 38:1-7 that we read to form the confederacies that attack Israel can be identified in Genesis, the 10th chapter. This is the chapter that identifies the offspring of Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And you can see here's Noah, here's Japheth, Ham, and Shem, and here's their offspring or their sons. And then they go to their grandsons after that. Magog was the second son. That's right here. Well, you can see it. Second son listed in Ezekiel 38. Magog was often referred to by the Greek name Scythian. And these people lived in the northern regions above the Caucasus Mountains, settling north of the Black Sea. And that area is what we know to be Russia. Meshach, Tubal, and Gomer were also sons of Japheth and are presumed to be located as shown on this map. In the Talmud, Gomer is spoken of as Germani, that is Germany. The present divided land of Germany was first called the land of Gomer or Gomerland, and many old maps bear the name of Ashkenazah, and that was Gomer's son. One of the sons of Gomer is most likely represented by the Eastern European countries or in that approximate area. Let's see if I can make that bigger again. You can see Gomer here and his son Ashkenaz. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Pegarma was the son of Gomer and therefore Noah's great-grandson. We can't be certain that the locations shown are the most accurate. We should note that Brother Richard Doctor offered a scholarly article that appeared in the November 2022 Beauties of the Truth, in which he offers the possibility, or should I say the suggestion, that the house of Pegarma could include the people of China based on cultural reasons. He says DNA studies conclude the possibility that the Chinese descended from Japheth, but also agrees that they could have descended from Shem. The point is those who descended under the umbrella of Pegarma, meaning the house of Pegarma, could include the Chinese, and if so, be part of the coalition that goes against Israel. My personal belief is they are not included in the house of Pegarma. Yet when we look at the world stage, we see a current view of the China-Russia relationship. It certainly favors an alliance between those two rather than between China and the Western nations. Further observation as time goes on will make this possibility clearer. It's interesting to note that the vast majority of the nations identified in Ezekiel 38, along with the republics of the former Soviet Union that go against Israel, are Islamic. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya are also included in the Confederacy, and two are Islamic. Persia, in all probability, is considered to be the area occupied by current Iran. Ethiopia is the land area occupied by the descendants of Cush, the firstborn son of Ham, and that's located around the southern parts of the Nile. Libya, a nation of people now in northern Africa, descended from Put, Ham's thirdborn son. More specifically, we suggest the possible locations of where these descendants settled, as shown on the map that you've seen before, this one. Looking at a current map, we believe Magog in this use represents Russia and its satellites. And there's a lot of stands, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and so forth. Persia is Iran, Kush is Ethiopia, Put is Libya, and Turkey and surrounding areas are represented by Meshech, Tubal, and Togarma. These three of Japheth's offspring. In summary, Magog refers to the ancient tribal groups that once occupied the area that now comprises Russia and modern Central Asia, including several of the southern Islamic republics of the Commonwealth of Independent States. Ezekiel's description of Magog is in the parts of the north. If we look at a map, we can see Russia is in parts of the north. I'm going to make this a little bigger. In fact, using a longitudinal line going through Moscow, you can see using the curvature of the earth, the longitudinal line that goes through Israel is close to the same. The longitude of Moscow is 37.62 degrees east. Latitude, you'll remember, is measured north or south from the equator, whereas longitude is measured east and west from the prime meridian running through Greenwich, England. Jerusalem's longitude is 35.20 degrees east. 1 degree of longitude equals 54.6 miles. Therefore, taking the difference between the two longitudes and multiplying by 54.6 equals 132 miles east of being exactly north of Jerusalem. And this, I believe, is interesting in location, that being in the north part. Well, let's now talk about current day. Vladimir Putin met with Iranian and Turkish leaders in Tehran in the mid-July of 2022. From what I have learned, these three nations have not been aligned previously. Additionally, Turkey is a member of NATO and has in the recent past sought membership into the European Union. Russia and Iran have not been friendly in the past. You may recall the Ayatollah Khomeini rejected relations with Russia due to religious reasons. But after his death, Russia began selling arms to Iran. Russia had a cooperative hand in completing the nuclear power plant, and both are in agreement regarding the civil war in Syria. Both countries agree on keeping Syrian President Bashar Assad in power for selfish reasons. Russia wants access to the Syrian naval base in Tartus, as well as curtailing ISIS. Iran is also an ally of Syria and is a sponsor of Hezbollah, a radical terrorist organization that operates under Assad. So how does Turkey fit into the picture? After World War I, Turkey inaugurated a very Western diplomatic republic. In 1949, Turkey became the first Muslim-majority nation to recognize Israel. In 1952, Turkey joined NATO. And for the latter part of 20th century, Turkey was a strong ally of Israel, the United States, and other Western nations. As the 21st century rolled around, Turkey explored membership in the European Union. But then there was a change in attitude. Recep Erdogan was elected prime minister in 2003. He served for prime minister until 2014, when he was elected president of Turkey. He has over the years changed the government from a secular republic to one directed more toward Islamic values. In 2017, he won a referendum granting him sweeping presidential powers. Although some of the reforms he put in place greatly helped the economic position of the country, Mr. Erdogan has long championed Islamic causes and was purported to give the four-finger salute of Egypt's repressed Muslim Brotherhood. Mr. Erdogan has cemented his strongman position as the dominant leader of Turkey. He has long held close ties with Russia's Vladimir Putin and has sought a pivotal role as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. Despite being the leader of a NATO state, he bought a Russian anti-missile defense system and chose Russia to build Turkey's first nuclear reactor. He continues to enjoy a close relationship with Russia. And now this is not a judgment of his heart, his character, or his values. It's just a fact, and I'm just pointing that out. The scripture tells us in Ezekiel 38:16, "And thou shalt come against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. In these last days, the closing days of the time of trouble, God will set apart and be seen by all as the conqueror. Because God will fight for Israel, he will fight for his people." Zechariah 14, verses 2 and 3 tell us, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished. And half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of people shall not be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, as when he fought in the day of battle. At the start of the battle, Israel will be on the path of defeat, but then the Lord intervenes. God will fight for Israel as in the days of the past." Isaiah 28:21 gives examples of how God delivered Israel in the past. It reads, "For the Lord shall rise up as in Mount Perazim. He shall be wroth as in Valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, to bring to pass his act, his strange act." The Lord delivered Israel from the Philistines at Perazim through David. The Lord delivered Israel from the Amorites at Gibeon through Joshua. It may seem strange to others that the Lord allows evil to prosper. He is waiting for the completion of the church before the true and final deliverance is accomplished. This final conflict will be the end of Jacob's trouble. As we read in Ezekiel 38:23, "And so I will show my greatness and my holiness, and I will make myself known in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord." I found this interesting chart that shows the differences between Psalm 83 battle and the Ezekiel 38 battle. Note the different enemies, the different motives, the different reasons for the victories, and the different results from the two battle views. Well, we were going to talk about the spoil in Israel that would be attractive to the other nations, but we will skip that. And I'll just end with this, that some may say this is a prophecy and will not know the outcome until it's over and all the details are made plain. And that, of course, is certainly true. Perhaps looking into future events is considered not very productive. But I hope not. It's the examining prophecies that have increased my faith, seeing after the fact how accurate what we believe forms God's plan in our minds, and projecting future events to see how they fulfill the plan. We're told in Matthew 24, the Lord's great prophecy, his instruction to watch. Jesus told his disciples this 2 days before the Passover, when he was betrayed, arrested, and began the terrible ordeal of his trial and crucifixion. So I hope you found this acceptable and useful in increasing your faith. And as our Lord told us, watch.